to which we are subject as part of our punishment for Adam's sin. This discussion is very important as revealing the psychology of asceticism. We must therefore go into it, although the saint confesses that the theme is immodest. The theory advanced is as follows. It must be admitted that sexual intercourse in marriage is not sinful, provided the intention is to beget offspring. Yet, even in marriage, a virtuous man will wish that he could manage without lust. Even in marriage, as the desire for privacy shows, people are ashamed of sexual intercourse because this lawful act of nature is, from our first parents, accompanied with our penal shame. The Cynics thought that one should be without shame, and Diogenes would have none of it, wishing to be in all things like a dog. Yet even he, after one attempt, abandoned in practice this extreme of shamelessness. What is shameful about lust is its independence of the will. Adam and Eve, before the fall, could have had sexual intercourse without lust, though in fact they did not. Handicraftsmen, in the pursuit of their trade, move their hands without lust. Similarly, Adam, if only he had kept away from the apple tree, could have performed the business of sex without the emotions that it now demands. The sexual members, like the rest of the body, would have obeyed the will. The need of lust in sexual intercourse is a punishment for Adam's sin, but for which sex might have been divorced from pleasure. Omitting some physiological details, which the translator has very properly left in the decent obscurity of the original Latin, the above is St. Augustine's theory as regards sex. It is evident from the above that what makes the ascetic dislike sex is its independence of the will. Virtue, it is held, demands a complete control of the will over the body, but such control does not suffice to make the sexual act possible. The sexual act, therefore, seems inconsistent with a perfectly virtuous life. Ever since the fall, the world has been divided into two cities, of which one shall reign eternally with God, the other shall be in eternal torment with Satan. Cain belongs to the city of the devil, Abel to the city of God. Abel, by grace and in virtue of predestination, was a pilgrim on earth and a citizen of heaven. The patriarchs belonged to the city of God. Discussion of the death of Methuselah brings St. Augustine to the vexed question of the comparison of the Septuagint with the Vulgate. The data, as given in the Septuagint, lead to the conclusion that Methuselah survived the flood by 14 years, which is impossible, since he was not in the ark. The Vulgate, following the Hebrew manuscript, gives data from which it follows that he died the year of the flood. On this point, St. Augustine holds that St. Jerome and the Hebrew manuscript must be right. Some people maintained that the Jews had deliberately falsified the Hebrew manuscript out of malice towards the Christians. This hypothesis is rejected. On the other hand, the Septuagint must have been divinely inspired. The only conclusion is that Ptolemy's copyists made mistakes in transcribing the Septuagint. Speaking of the translations of the Old Testament, he says, "The Church has received that of the 70 as if there were no other, as many of the Greek Christians, using this holy, know not whether there be or no." Our Latin translation is from this also, although one Jerome, a learned priest and a great linguist, has translated the same scriptures from the Hebrew into Latin. But although the Jews affirm his learned labor to be all truth, and avouch the 70 to have oftentimes erred, yet the churches of Christ hold no one man to be preferred before so many, especially being selected by the high priest for this work. He accepts the story of the miraculous agreement of the 70 independent translations, and considers this a proof that the Septuagint is divinely inspired. The Hebrew, however, is equally inspired. This conclusion leaves undecided the question as to the authority of Jerome's translation. Perhaps he might have been more decidedly on Jerome's side if the two saints had not had a quarrel about St. Peter's time-serving propensities. Footnote, Galatians chapter 2, verses 11 through 14. End of footnote. He gives a synchronism of sacred and profane history. We learn that Aeneas came to Italy when Abdon was judge in Israel, and that the last persecution will be under Antichrist, but its date is unknown. Footnote: of Abdon, we know only that he had 40 sons and 30 nephews, and that all these 70 rode donkeys. Judges chapter 12, verse 14. End of footnote. After an admirable chapter against judicial torture, St. Augustine proceeds to combat the new academicians, who hold all things to be doubtful. The Church of Christ detests these doubts as madness, having a most certain knowledge of the things it apprehends. We should believe in the truth of the Scriptures. He goes on to explain that there is no true virtue apart from true religion. Pagan virtue is prostituted with the influence of obscene and filthy devils. What would be virtues in a Christian are vices in a pagan. Those things which she, the soul, seems to account virtues, and thereby to sway her affections, if they be not all referred unto God, are indeed vices rather than virtues. They that are not of this society, the Church, shall suffer eternal misery. In our conflicts here on earth, either the pain is victor, and so death expels the sense of it, or nature conquers and expels the pain. But there pain shall afflict eternally, and nature shall suffer eternally, both enduring to the continuance of the inflicted punishment. There are two resurrections, that of the soul at death, and that of the body at the last judgment. After a discussion of various difficulties concerning the millennium and the subsequent doings of Gog and Magog, he comes to a text in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that all they might be damned who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Some people might think it unjust that the Omnipotent should first deceive them and then punish them for being deceived. But to St. Augustine, this seems quite in order. Being condemned, they are seduced, and being seduced, condemned. But their seducement is by the secret judgment of God, justly secret, and secretly just. Even his that hath judged continually, ever since the world began. St. Augustine holds that God divided mankind into the elect and the reprobate, not because of their merits or demerits, but arbitrarily. All alike deserve damnation, and therefore the reprobate have no ground of complaint. From the above passage of St. Paul, it appears that they are wicked because they are reprobate, not reprobate because they are wicked. After the resurrection of the bodies of the damned will burn eternally without being consumed. In this there is nothing strange. It happens to the salamander and Mount Etna. Devils, though incorporeal, can be burnt by corporeal fire. Hell's torments are not purifying, and will not be lessened by the intercessions of saints. Origen erred in thinking hell not eternal. Heretics and sinful Catholics will be damned. The book ends with a description of the saints' vision of God in heaven, and of the eternal felicity of the city of God. From the above summary, the importance of the work may not be clear. What was influential was the separation of church and state, with the clear implication that the state could only be part of the city of God by being submissive towards the church in all religious matters. This has been the doctrine of the church ever since. All through the Middle Ages, during the gradual rise of the papal power, and throughout the conflict between Pope and Emperor, St. Augustine supplied the Western Church with a theoretical justification of its policy. The Jewish state, in the legendary time of the Judges, and in the historical period after the return from the Babylonian captivity, had been a theocracy. The Christian state should imitate it in this respect. The weakness of the emperors and of most Western medieval monarchs enabled the Church, to a great extent, to realize the ideal of the City of God. In the East, where the emperor was strong, this development never took place, and the Church remained much more subject to the state than it became in the West. The Reformation, which revived St. Augustine's doctrine of salvation, threw over his theocratic teaching and became Erastian, largely owing to the practical exigencies of the fight with Catholicism. Footnote: Erastianism is the doctrine that the church should be subject to the state. End of footnote. But Protestant Erastianism was half-hearted, and the most religious among Protestants were still influenced by St. Augustine. Anabaptists, Fifth Monarchy men, and Quakers took over a part of his doctrine, but laid less stress on the church. He held to predestination and also to the need of baptism for salvation. These two doctrines do not harmonize well, and the extreme Protestants threw over the latter. But their eschatology remained Augustinian. The City of God contains little that is fundamentally original. The eschatology is Jewish in origin and came into Christianity mainly through the Book of Revelation. The doctrine of predestination and election is Pauline, though St. Augustine gave it a much fuller and more logical development than is to be found in the epistles. The distinction between sacred and profane history is quite clearly set forth in the Old Testament. What St. Augustine did was to bring these elements together and to relate them to the history of his own time in such a way that the fall of the Western Empire and the subsequent period of confusion could be assimilated by Christians without any unduly severe trial of their faith. The Jewish pattern of history, past and future, is such as to make a powerful appeal to the oppressed and unfortunate at all times. St. Augustine adapted this pattern to Christianity, Marx to socialism. To understand Marx psychologically, one should use the following dictionary. Yahweh equals dialectical materialism. The Messiah equals Marx. The elect equals the proletariat. The church equals the Communist Party. The Second Coming equals the revolution. Hell equals punishment of the capitalists. The millennium equals the communist commonwealth. The terms on the left give the emotional content of the terms on the right. And it is this emotional content, familiar to those who have had a Christian or a Jewish upbringing, that makes Marx's eschatology credible. A similar dictionary could be made for the Nazis, but their conceptions are more purely Old Testament and less Christian than those of Marx, and their Messiah is more analogous to the Maccabees than to Christ. 3. The Pelagian Controversy. Much of the most influential part of St. Augustine's theology was concerned in combating the Pelagian heresy. Pelagius was a Welshman whose real name was Morgan, which means man of the sea, as Pelagius does in Greek. He was a cultivated and agreeable ecclesiastic, less fanatical than many of his contemporaries. He believed in free will, questioned the doctrine of original sin, and thought that when men act virtuously, it is by virtue of their own moral effort. If they act rightly and are orthodox, they go to heaven as a reward of their virtues. These views, though they may now seem commonplace, caused at the time a great commotion, and were, largely through St. Augustine's efforts, declared heretical. They had, however, a considerable temporary success. Augustine had to write to the Patriarch of Jerusalem to warn him against the wily heresiarch, who had persuaded many Eastern theologians to adopt his views. Even after his condemnation, other people, called semi-Pelagians, advocated weakened forms of his doctrines. It was a long time before the purer teaching of the saint was completely victorious, especially in France, where the final condemnation of the semi-Pelagian heresy took place at the Council of Orange in 529. St. Augustine taught that Adam, before the fall, had had free will and could have abstained from sin. But as he and Eve ate the apple, corruption entered into them and descended to all their posterity, none of whom can, of their own power, abstain from sin. Only God's grace enables men to be virtuous. Since we all inherit Adam's sin, we all deserve eternal damnation. All who die unbaptized, even infants, will go to hell and suffer unending torment. We have no reason to complain of this, since we are all wicked. In the Confessions, the saint enumerates the crimes of which he was guilty in the cradle. But by God's free grace, certain people, among those who have been baptized, are chosen to go to heaven. These are the elect. They do not go to heaven because they are good. We are all totally depraved, except in so far as God's grace, which is only bestowed on the elect, enables us to be otherwise. No reason can be given why some are saved and the rest damned. This is due to God's unmotived choice. Damnation proves God's justice, salvation his mercy. Both equally display his goodness. The arguments in favor of this ferocious doctrine, which was revived by Calvin and has since then not been held by the Catholic Church, are to be found in the writings of St. Paul, particularly the Epistle to the Romans. These are treated by Augustine as a lawyer treats the law. The interpretation is able, and the texts are made to yield their utmost meaning. One is persuaded at the end, not that St. Paul believed what Augustine deduces, but that, taking certain texts in isolation, they do imply just what he says they do. It may seem odd that the damnation of unbaptized infants should not have been thought shocking, but should have been attributed to a good God. The conviction of sin, however, so dominated him that he really believed newborn children to be limbs of Satan. A great deal of what is most ferocious in the medieval church is traceable to his gloomy sense of universal guilt. There is only one intellectual difficulty that really troubles St. Augustine. This is not that it seems a pity to have created man, since the immense majority of the human race are predestined to eternal torment. What troubles him is that if original sin is inherited from Adam, as St. Paul teaches, the soul, as well as the body, must be propagated by the parents, for sin is of the soul, not the body. He sees difficulties in this doctrine, but says that, since Scripture is silent, it cannot be necessary to salvation to arrive at a just view on the matter. He therefore leaves it undecided. It is strange that the last men of intellectual eminence before the Dark Ages were concerned not with saving civilization or expelling the barbarians, or reforming the abuses of the administration, but with preaching the merit of virginity and the damnation of unbaptized infants. Seeing that these were the preoccupations that the Church handed on to the converted barbarians, it is no wonder that the succeeding age surpassed almost all other fully historical periods in cruelty and superstition. Chapter 5, the 5th and 6th centuries. The 5th century was that of the barbarian invasion and the fall of the Western Empire. After the death of Augustine in 430, there was little philosophy. It was a century of destructive action, which, however, largely determined the lines upon which Europe was to be developed. It was in this century that the English invaded Britain, causing it to become England. It was also in this century that the Frankish invasion turned Gaul into France, and that the Vandals invaded Spain, giving their name to Andalusia. St. Patrick, during the middle years of the century, converted the Irish to Christianity. Throughout the Western world, rough Germanic kingdoms succeeded the centralized bureaucracy of the empire. The imperial post ceased. The great roads fell into decay. War put an end to large-scale commerce, and life again became local, both politically and economically. Centralized authority was preserved only in the church, and there was much difficulty. Of the Germanic tribes that invaded the empire in the 5th century, the most important were the Goths. They were pushed westward by the Huns, who attacked them from the east. At first they tried to conquer the Eastern Empire, but were defeated. Then they turned upon Italy. Since Diocletian, they had been employed as Roman mercenaries. This had taught them more of the art of war than barbarians would otherwise have known. Alaric, king of the Goths, sacked Rome in 410, but died the same year. Odovaker, king of the Ostrogoths, put an end to the Western Empire in 476 and reigned until 493, when he was treacherously murdered by another Ostrogoth, Theodoric, who was king of Italy until 526. Of him I shall have more to say shortly. He was important both in history and legend. In the Nibelungenlied, he appears as Dietrich von Bern, Bern being Verona. Meanwhile, the Vandals established themselves in Africa, the Visigoths in the south of France, and the Franks in the north. In the middle of the Germanic invasion came the inroads of the Huns under Attila. The Huns were of Mongol race, and yet they were often allied with the Goths. At the crucial moment, however, when they invaded Gaul in 451, they had quarreled with the Goths. The Goths and Romans together defeated them in that year at Chalons. Attila then turned against Italy and thought of marching on Rome, but Pope Leo dissuaded him. pointing out that Alaric had died after sacking Rome. His forbearance, however, did him no service, for he died in the following year. After his death, the power of the Huns collapsed. During this period of confusion, the church was troubled by a complicated controversy on the incarnation. The protagonists in the debates were two ecclesiastics, Cyril and Nestorius, of whom more or less by accident the former was proclaimed a saint and the latter a heretic. St. Cyril was Patriarch of Alexandria from about 412 till his death in 444. Nestorius was Patriarch of Constantinople. The question at issue was the relation of Christ's divinity to his humanity. Were there two persons, one human and one divine? This was the view held by Nestorius. If not, was there only one nature, or were there two natures in one person, a human nature and a divine nature? These questions roused in the 5th century an almost incredible degree of passion and fury. A secret and incurable discord was cherished between those who were most apprehensive of confounding and those who were most fearful of separating the divinity and the humanity of Christ. St. Cyril, the advocate of unity, was a man of fanatical zeal. He used his position as patriarch to incite pogroms of the very large Jewish colony in Alexandria. His chief claim to fame is the lynching of Hypatia, a distinguished lady who, in an age of bigotry, adhered to the Neoplatonic philosophy and devoted her talents to mathematics. She was torn from her chariot, stripped naked, dragged to the church, and inhumanly butchered by the hands of Peter the Reader and a troop of savage and merciless fanatics. Her flesh was scraped from her bones with sharp oyster shells, and her quivering limbs were delivered to the flames. The just progress of inquiry and punishment was stopped by seasonable gifts. After this, Alexandria was no longer troubled by philosophers. St. Cyril was pained to learn that Constantinople was being led astray by the teaching of its patriarch Nestorius, who maintained that there were two persons in Christ, one human and one divine. On this ground, Nestorius objected to the new practice of calling the Virgin Mother of God. She was, he said, only the mother of the human person, while the divine person, who was God, had no mother. On this question, the church was divided. Roughly speaking, bishops east of Suez favored Nestorius, while those west of Suez favored St. Cyril. A council was summoned to meet at Ephesus in 431 to decide the question. The western bishops arrived first and proceeded to lock the doors against latecomers and decide in hot haste for St. Cyril, who presided. This episcopal tumult, at the distance of 13 centuries, assumes the venerable aspect of the Third Ecumenical Council. As a result of this council, Nestorius was condemned as a heretic. He did not recant, but was the founder of the Nestorian sect, which had a large following in Syria and throughout the East. Some centuries later, Nestorianism was so strong in China that it seemed to have a chance of becoming the established religion. Nestorians were found in India by the Spanish and Portuguese missionaries in the 16th century. The persecution of Nestorianism by the Catholic government of Constantinople caused disaffection, which helped the Mohammedans in their conquest of Syria. The tongue of Nestorius, by which its eloquence had seduced so many, was eaten by worms, so at least we are assured. Ephesus had learnt to substitute the Virgin for Artemis, but had still the same intemperate zeal for its goddess as in the time of St. Paul. It was said that the Virgin was buried there. In 449, after the death of St. Cyril, a synod at Ephesus tried to carry the triumph further, and thereby fell into the heresy opposite to that of Nestorius. This is called the Monophysite heresy, and maintains that Christ has only one nature. If St. Cyril had still been alive, he would certainly have supported this view and have become heretical. The emperor supported the synod, but the pope repudiated it. At last, Pope Leo, the same pope who turned Attila from attacking Rome in the year of the Battle of Chalons, secured the summoning of an ecumenical council at Chalcedon in 451, which condemned the Monophysites and finally decided the orthodox doctrine of the Incarnation. The Council of Ephesus had decided that there is only one person of Christ, but the Council of Chalcedon decided that he exists in two natures, one human and one divine. The influence of the Pope was paramount in securing this decision. The Monophysites, like the Nestorians, refused to submit. Egypt, almost to a man, adopted their heresy, which spread up the Nile and as far as Abyssinia. The heresy of Egypt, like the opposite heresy of Syria, facilitated the Arab conquest. The heresy of the Abyssinians was given by Mussolini as one of his reasons for conquering them. During the 6th century, there were four men of great importance in the history of culture: Boethius, Justinian, Benedict, and Gregory the Great. They will be my chief concern in the remainder of this chapter and in the next. The Gothic conquest of Italy did not put an end to Roman civilization. Under Theodoric, king of Italy and of the Goths, the civil administration of Italy was entirely Roman. Italy enjoyed peace and religious toleration till near the end. The king was both wise and vigorous. He appointed consuls, preserved Roman law, and kept up the Senate. When in Rome, his first visit was to Senate House. Though an Arian, Theodoric was on good terms with the church until his last years. In 523, the Emperor Justin proscribed Arianism, and this annoyed Theodoric. He had reason for fear, since Italy was Catholic and was led by theological sympathy to side with the Emperor. He believed, rightly or wrongly, that there was a plot involving men in his own government. This led him to imprison and execute his minister, the senator Boethius, whose Consolations of Philosophy was written while he was imprisoned. Boethius is a singular figure. Throughout the Middle Ages, he was read and admired, regarded always as a devout Christian, and treated almost as if he had been one of the fathers. Yet his Consolations of Philosophy, written in 524 while he was awaiting execution, is purely Platonic. It does not prove that he was not a Christian, but it does show that pagan philosophy had a much stronger hold on him than Christian theology. Some theological works, especially one on the Trinity, which are attributed to him, are by many authorities considered to be spurious. But it was probably owing to them that the Middle Ages were able to regard him as orthodox, and to imbibe from him much Platonism which would otherwise have been viewed with suspicion. The work is an alternation of verse and prose. Boethius, in his own person, speaks in prose, while philosophy answers in verse. There is a certain resemblance to Dante, who was no doubt influenced by him in the Vita Nuova. The Consolations, which Gibbon rightly calls a golden volume, begins by the statement that Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle are the true philosophers. Stoics, Epicureans, and the rest are usurpers, whom the profane multitude mistook for the friends of philosophy. Boethius says he obeyed the Pythagorean command to follow God, not the Christian command. Happiness, which is the same thing as blessedness, is the good, not pleasure. Friendship is a most sacred thing. There is much morality that agrees closely with Stoic doctrine, and is in fact largely taken from Seneca. There is a summary, in verse, of the beginning of the Timaeus. This is followed by a great deal of purely Platonic metaphysics. Imperfection, we are told, is a lack, implying the existence of a perfect pattern. He adopts the privative theory of evil. He then passes on to a pantheism which should have shocked Christians, but for some reason did not. Blessedness and God, he says, are both the chiefest good, and are therefore identical. Men are made happy by the obtaining of divinity. They who obtain divinity become gods. Wherefore every one that is happy is a god, but by nature there is only one God, but there may be many by participation. The sum, origin, and cause of all that is sought after is rightly thought to be goodness. The substance of God consisteth in nothing else but in goodness. Can God do evil? No. Therefore evil is nothing, since God can do everything. Virtuous men are always powerful, and bad men always weak. For both desire the good, but only the virtuous get it. The wicked are more unfortunate if they escape punishment than if they suffer it. Note that this could not be said of punishment in hell. In wise men there is no place for hatred. The tone of the book is more like that of Plato than that of Plotinus. There is no trace of the superstition or morbidness of the age, no obsession with sin, no excessive straining after the unattainable. there is perfect philosophic calm, so much that if the book had been written in prosperity, it might almost have been called smug. Written when it was, in prison, under sentence of death, it is as admirable as the last moments of the Platonic Socrates. One does not find a similar outlook until after Newton. I will quote in extenso one poem from the book, which in its philosophy is not unlike Pope's Essay on Man. If thou wouldst see God's laws with purest mind, thy sight on heaven must fixed be, whose settled course the stars in peace doth bind. The sun's bright fire stops not his sister's team, nor doth the northern bear desire within the ocean's wave to hide her beam. Though she behold the other stars there couching, yet she incessantly is rolled about high heaven, the ocean never touching. The evening light with certain course doth show the coming of the shady night, and Lucifer before the day doth go. This mutual love courses eternal makes, and from the starry spheres above all cause of war and dangerous discord takes. This sweet consent in equal bands doth tie the nature of each element, so that the moist things yield unto the dry. The piercing cold with flames doth friendship heap, the trembling fire the highest place doth hold, and the gross earth sinks down into the deep. The flowery year breathes odors in the spring, the scorching summer corn doth bear, the autumn fruit from laden trees doth bring. The falling rain doth winter's moisture give. These rules thus nourish and maintain all creatures which we see on earth to live. And when they die, these bring them to their end, while their Creator sits on high, whose hand the reins of the whole world doth bend. He, as their king, rules them with lordly might. From him they rise, flourish, and spring. He, as their law and judge, decides their right. Those things whose course most swiftly glides away, his might doth often backward force, and suddenly their wandering motion stay. Unless his strength their violence should bound, and them which else would run at length, should bring within the compass of a round that firm decree which now doth all adorn, would soon destroyed and broken be, things being far from their beginning born. This powerful love is common unto all, which for desire of good do move back to the springs from whence they first did fall. No worldly thing can a continuance have, unless love back again it bring, unto the cause which first the essence gave. Boethius was, until the end, a friend of Theodoric. His father was consul, he was consul, and so were his two sons. His father-in-law, Symmachus, probably grandson of the one who had a controversy with Ambrose about the Statue of Victory, was an important man in the court of the Gothic king. Theodoric employed Boethius to reform the coinage and to astonish less sophisticated barbarian kings with such devices as sundials and water clocks. It may be that his freedom from superstition was not so exceptional in Roman aristocratic families as elsewhere, but its combination with great learning and zeal for the public good was unique in that age. During the 2 centuries before his time and the 10 centuries after it, I cannot think of any European man of learning so free from superstition and fanaticism. Nor are his merits merely negative. His survey is lofty, disinterested, and sublime. He would have been remarkable in any age. In the age in which he lived, he is utterly amazing. The medieval reputation of Boethius was partly due to his being regarded as a martyr to Arian persecution, a view which began 200 or 300 years after his death. In Pavia he was regarded as a saint, but in fact he was not canonized. Though Cyril was a saint, Boethius was not. 2 years after the execution of Boethius, Theodoric died. In the next year, Justinian became emperor. He reigned until 565, and in this long time managed to do much harm and some good. He is, of course, chiefly famous for his digest, but I shall not venture on this topic, which is one for the lawyers. He was a man of deep piety, which he signalized 2 years after his accession by closing the schools of philosophy in Athens, where paganism still reigned. The dispossessed philosophers betook themselves to Persia, where the king received them kindly, but they were shocked, more so, says Gibbon, than became philosophers, by the Persian practices of polygamy and incest. So they returned home again and faded into obscurity. 3 years after this exploit, 532, Justinian embarked upon another, more worthy of praise, the building of St. Sophia. I have never seen St. Sophia, but I have seen the beautiful contemporary mosaics at Ravenna, including portraits of Justinian and his empress Theodora. Both were very pious, though Theodora was a lady of easy virtue whom he had picked up in the circus. What is even worse, she was inclined to be a Monophysite. But enough of scandal. The emperor himself, I am happy to say, was of impeccable orthodoxy, except in the matter of the three chapters. This was a vexatious controversy. The Council of Chalcedon had pronounced orthodox three fathers suspected of Nestorianism. Theodora, along with many others, accepted all the other decrees of the council, but not this one. The Western Church stood by everything decided by the council, and the empress was driven to persecute the pope. Justinian adored her, and after her death in 548, she became to him what the dead prince consort was to Queen Victoria. So in the end, he lapsed into heresy. A contemporary historian, Evagrius, writes, "Having since the end of his life received the wages of his misdeeds, he has gone to seek the justice which was his due before the judgment seat of hell." Justinian aspired to reconquer as much as possible of the Western Empire. In 535 he invaded Italy, and at first had quick success against the Goths. The Catholic population welcomed him, and he came as representing Rome against the barbarians. But the Goths rallied, and the war lasted 18 years, during which Rome and Italy generally suffered far more than in the barbarian invasion. Rome was 5 times captured, thrice by Byzantines, twice by Goths, and sank to a small town. The same sort of thing happened in Africa, which Justinian also more or less reconquered. At first, his armies were welcomed. Then it was found that Byzantine administration was corrupt and Byzantine taxes were ruinous. In the end, many people wished the Goths and Vandals back. The church, however, until his last years, was steadily on the side of the emperor because of his orthodoxy. He did not attempt the reconquest of Gaul, partly because of distance, but partly also because the Franks were orthodox. In 568, 3 years after Justinian's death, Italy was invaded by a new and very fierce German tribe, the Lombards. Wars between them and the Byzantines continued intermittently for 200 years, until nearly the time of Charlemagne. The Byzantines held gradually less and less of Italy. In the south, they had also to face the Saracens. Rome remained nominally subject to them, and the popes treated the eastern emperors with deference. But in most parts of Italy, the emperors, after the coming of the Lombards, had very little authority, or even none at all. It was this period that ruined Italian civilization. It was refugees from the Lombards who founded Venice, not, as tradition avers, fugitives from Attila. Chapter 6. St. Benedict and Gregory the Great. In the general decay of civilization that came about during the incessant wars of the 6th and succeeding centuries, it was above all the Church that preserved whatever survived of the culture of ancient Rome. The Church performed this work very imperfectly, because fanaticism and superstition prevailed among even the greatest ecclesiastics of the time, and secular learning was thought wicked. Nevertheless, ecclesiastical institutions created a solid framework, within which, in later times, a revival of learning and civilized arts became possible. In the period with which we are concerned, 3 of the activities of the Church call for special notice. First, the monastic movement. Second, the influence of the papacy, especially under Gregory the Great. Third, the conversion of the heathen barbarians by means of missions. I will say something about each of these in succession. The monastic movement began simultaneously in Egypt and Syria about the beginning of the 4th century. It had two forms, that of solitary hermits and that of monasteries. St. Anthony, the first of the hermits, was born in Egypt about 250 and withdrew from the world about 270. For 15 years he lived alone in a hut near his home, then for 20 years in remote solitude in the desert. But his fame spread, and multitudes longed to hear him preach. Accordingly, about 305, he came forth to teach and to encourage the hermit's life. He practiced extreme austerities, reducing food, drink, and sleep to the minimum required to support life. The devil constantly assailed him with lustful visions, but he manfully withstood the malign diligence of Satan. By the end of his life, the Thebaid, the desert near Egyptian Thebes, was full of hermits who had been inspired by his example and his precepts. A few years later, about 315 or 320, another Egyptian, Pachomius, founded the first monastery. Here the monks had a common life, without private property, with communal meals and communal religious observations. It was in this form, rather than in that of St. Anthony, that monasticism conquered the Christian world. In the monasteries derived from Pachomius, the monks did much work, chiefly agricultural, instead of spending the whole of their time in resisting the temptations of the flesh. At about the same time, monasticism sprang up in Syria and Mesopotamia. Here, asceticism was carried to even greater lengths than in Egypt. St. Simeon Stylites and the other pillar hermits were Syrian. It was from the east that monasticism came to Greek-speaking countries, chiefly owing to St. Basil, about 360. His monasteries were less ascetic. They had orphanages and schools for boys, not only for such as intended to become monks. At first, monasticism was a spontaneous movement, quite outside church organization. It was St. Athanasius who reconciled ecclesiastics to it. Partly as a result of his influence, it came to be the rule that monks should be priests. It was he also, while he was in Rome in 339, who introduced the movement into the West. St. Jerome did much to promote it, and St. Augustine introduced it into Africa. St. Martin of Tours inaugurated monasteries in Gaul, St. Patrick in Ireland. The monastery of Iona was founded by St. Columba in 566. In early days, before monks had been fitted into the ecclesiastical organization, they had been a source of disorder. To begin with, there was no way of discriminating between genuine ascetics and men who, being destitute, found monastic establishments comparatively luxurious. Then again, there was the difficulty that the monks gave a turbulent support to their favorite bishop, causing synods and almost causing councils to fall into heresy. The synod, not the Council of Ephesus, which decided for the Monophysites, was under a monkish reign of terror. But for the resistance of the Pope, the victory of the Monophysites might have been permanent. In later times, such disorders no longer occurred. There seem to have been nuns before there were monks, as early as the middle of the 3rd century. Some shut themselves up in tombs. Cleanliness was viewed with abhorrence. Lice were called pearls of God and were a mark of saintliness. Saints, male and female, would boast that water had never touched their feet except when they had to cross rivers. In later centuries, monks served many useful purposes. They were skilled agriculturists, and some of them kept alive or revived learning. But in the beginning, especially in the eremitic section, there was none of this. Most monks did no work, never read anything except what religion prescribed, and conceived virtue in an entirely negative manner, as abstention from sin, especially the sins of the flesh. St. Jerome, it is true, took his library with him into the desert, but he came to think that this had been a sin. In Western monasticism, the most important name is that of St. Benedict, the founder of the Benedictine order. He was born about 480 near Spoleto, of a noble Umbrian family. At the age of 20, he fled from the luxuries and pleasures of Rome to the solitude of a cave, where he lived for 3 years. After this period, his life was less solitary, and about the year 520, he founded the famous monastery of Monte Cassino, for which he drew up the Benedictine rule. This was adapted to Western climates and demanded less austerity than had been common among Egyptian and Syrian monks. There had been an unedifying competition in ascetic extravagance, the most extreme practitioner being considered the most holy. To this, St. Benedict put an end, decreeing that austerities going beyond the rule could only be practiced by permission of the abbot. The abbot was given great power. He was elected for life and had, within the rule and the limits of orthodoxy, an almost despotic control over his monks, who were no longer allowed, as previously, to leave their monastery for another if they felt so inclined. In later times, Benedictines have been remarkable for learning, but at first all their reading was devotional. Organizations have a life of their own, independent of the intentions of their founders. Of this fact, the most striking example is the Catholic Church, which would astonish Jesus and even Paul. The Benedictine order is a lesser example. The monks take a vow of poverty, obedience, and chastity. As to this, Gibbon remarks, I have somewhere heard or read the frank confession of a Benedictine.
Well, never mind. But we.
The vow of poverty has given me 100,000 crowns a year. My vow of obedience has raised me to the rank of a sovereign prince. I forget the consequences of his vow of chastity. The departures of the order from the founder's intentions were, however, by no means all regrettable. This is true in particular of learning. The library of Monte Cassino is famous, and in various ways the world is much indebted to the scholarly tastes of later Benedictines. St. Benedict lived at Monte Cassino from its foundation until his death in 543. The monastery was sacked by the Lombards shortly before Gregory the Great, himself a Benedictine, became pope. The monks fled to Rome, but when the fury of the Lombards had abated, they returned to Monte Cassino. From the dialogues of Pope Gregory the Great, written in 593, we learn much about St. Benedict. He was brought up at Rome in the study of humanity. But forasmuch as he saw many, by the reason of such learning, to fall to dissolute and lewd life, he drew back his foot, which he had, as it were, now set forth into the world, lest, entering too far in acquaintance therewith, he likewise might have fallen into that dangerous and godless gulf. Wherefore, giving over his book, and forsaking his father's house and wealth, with a resolute mind only to serve God, he sought for some place where he might attain to the desire of his holy purpose. And in this sort he departed, instructed with learned ignorance, and furnished with unlearned wisdom. He immediately acquired the power to work miracles. The first of these was the mending of a broken sieve by means of prayer. The townsmen hung the sieve over the church door, and it continued there many years after, even to these very troubles of the Lombards. Abandoning the sieve, he went to his cave, unknown to all but one friend, who secretly supplied him with food let down by a rope, to which a bell was tied to let the saint know when his dinner had come. But Satan threw a stone at the rope, breaking both it and the bell. Nevertheless, the enemy of mankind was foiled in his hope of disrupting the saint's food supply. When Benedict had been as long in the cave as God's purposes required, our Lord appeared on Easter Sunday to a certain priest, revealed the hermit's whereabouts, and bade him share his Easter feast with the saint. About the same time, certain shepherds found him. At first, when they espied him through the bushes, and saw his apparel made of skins, they verily thought that it had been some beast. But after they were acquainted with the servant of God, many of them were by his means converted from their beastly life to grace, piety, and devotion. Like other hermits, Benedict suffered from the temptations of the flesh. A certain woman there was, which some time he had seen, the memory of which the wicked spirit put into his mind, and by the memory of her did so mightily inflame with concupiscence the soul of God's servant, which did so increase that, almost overcome with pleasure, he was of mind to have forsaken the wilderness. But suddenly, assisted with God's grace, he came to himself, and seeing many thick briars and nettle bushes to grow hard by, off he cast his apparel and threw himself into the midst of them, and there wallowed so long that when he rose up, all his flesh was pitifully torn, and so by the wounds of his body he cured the wounds of his soul. His fame being spread abroad, the monks of a certain monastery, whose abbot had lately died, besought him to accept the succession. He did so, and insisted upon observance of strict virtue, so that the monks, in a rage, decided to poison him with a glass of poisoned wine. He, however, made the sign of the cross over the glass, whereupon it broke in pieces. So he returned to the wilderness. The miracle of the sieve was not the only practically useful one performed by St. Benedict. One day, a virtuous Goth was using a billhook to clear away briars, when the head of it flew off the handle and fell into deep water. The saint, being informed, held the handle in the water, whereupon the iron head rose up and joined itself again to the handle. A neighboring priest, envious of the holy man's reputation, sent him a poisoned loaf. But Benedict miraculously knew it was poisoned. He had the habit of giving bread to a certain crow, and when the crow came on the day in question, the saint said to it, "In the name of Jesus Christ our Lord, take up that loaf, and leave it in some such place where no man may find it." The crow obeyed, and on its return was given its usual dinner. The wicked priest, seeing he could not kill Benedict's body, decided to kill his soul, and sent 7 naked young women into the monastery. The saint feared lest some of the younger monks might be moved to sin, and therefore departed himself, that the priest might no longer have a motive for such acts. But the priest was killed by the ceiling of his rooms falling on him. The monk pursued Benedict with the news, rejoicing and bidding him return. Benedict mourned over the death of the sinner, and imposed a penance on the monk for rejoicing. Gregory does not only relate miracles, but deigns now and then to tell facts in the career of St. Benedict. After founding 12 monasteries, he finally came to Monte Cassino, where there was a chapel to Apollo, still used by the country people for heathen worship. Even to that very time, the mad multitude of infidels did offer most wicked sacrifice. Benedict destroyed the altar, substituted a church, and converted the neighboring pagans. Satan was annoyed. The old enemy of mankind, not taking this in good part, did not now privily, or in a dream, but in open sight, present himself to the eyes of that holy father, and with great outcries complained that he had offered him violence. The noise which he made, the monks did hear, but himself they could not see. But as the venerable father told them, he appeared visibly unto him most fell and cruel, and as though, with his fiery mouth and flaming eyes, he would have torn him in pieces. What the devil said unto him, all the monks did hear, for first he would call him by his name, and because the man of God vouchsafed him not any answer, then would he fall a reviling and railing at him. For when he cried out, calling him Blessed Bennett, and yet found that he gave him no answer, straightways he would turn his tune and say, Cursed Bennett, and not blessed, what hast thou to do with me, and why dost thou thus persecute me? Here the story ends. One gathers that Satan gave up in despair. I have quoted at some length from these dialogues because they have a threefold importance. First, they are the principal source for our knowledge of the life of St. Benedict, whose rule became the model for all Western monasteries except those of Ireland or founded by Irishmen. Secondly, they give a vivid picture of the mental atmosphere among the most civilized people living at the end of the 6th century. Thirdly, they are written by Pope Gregory the Great, 4th and last of the doctors of the Western Church, and politically one of the most eminent of the popes. To him we must now turn our attention. The Venerable W. H. Hutton, Archdeacon of Northampton, claims that Gregory was the greatest man of the 6th century. The only rival claimants, he says, would be Justinian and St. Benedict. All three certainly had a profound effect on future ages. Justinian by his laws, not by his conquests, which were ephemeral, Benedict by his monastic order, and Gregory by the increase of papal power which he brought about. In the dialogues that I have been quoting, he appears childish and credulous, but as a statesman he is astute, masterful, and very well aware of what can be achieved in the complex and changing world in which he has to operate. The contrast is surprising, but the most effective men of action are often intellectually second-rate. Gregory the Great, the first pope of that name, was born in Rome about 540 of a rich and noble family. It seems his grandfather had been pope after he became a widower. He himself, as a young man, had a palace and immense wealth. He had what was considered a good education, though it did not include a knowledge of Greek, which he never acquired, although he lived for 6 years in Constantinople. In 573, he was prefect of the city of Rome. But religion claimed him. He resigned his office, gave his wealth to the founding of monasteries and to charity, and turned his own palace into a house for monks, himself becoming a Benedictine. He devoted himself to meditation and to austerities, which permanently injured his health. But Pope Pelagius II had become aware of his political abilities and sent him as his envoy to Constantinople, to which, since Justinian's time, Rome was nominally subject. Gregory lived in Constantinople from 579 to 585, representing papal interests at the emperor's court and papal theology in discussions with Eastern ecclesiastics, who were always more prone to heresy than those of the West. The Patriarch of Constantinople at this time held the erroneous opinion that our resurrection bodies will be impalpable, but Gregory saved the emperor from falling into this departure from the true faith. He was unable, however, to persuade the emperor to undertake a campaign against the Lombards, which was the principal object of his mission. The 5 years, 585 to 590, Gregory spent as head of his monastery. Then the pope died, and Gregory succeeded him. The times were difficult, but by their very confusion offered great opportunities to an able statesman. The Lombards were ravaging Italy. Spain and Africa were in a state of anarchy due to the weakness of the Byzantines and the decadence of Visigoths and the depredations of Moors. In France, there were wars between north and south. Britain, which had been Christian under the Romans, had reverted to paganism since the Saxon invasion. There were still remnants of Arianism, and the heresy of the three chapters was by no means extinct. The turbulent times infected even bishops, many of whom led far from exemplary lives. Simony was rife, and remained a crying evil until the latter half of the 11th century. All these sources of trouble Gregory combated with energy and sagacity. Before his pontificate, the Bishop of Rome, though acknowledged to be the greatest man in the hierarchy, was not regarded as having any jurisdiction outside his own diocese. St. Ambrose, for example, who was on the best of terms with the Pope of his day, obviously never regarded himself as in any degree subject to his authority. Gregory, owing partly to his personal qualities and partly to the prevailing anarchy, was able to assert successfully an authority which was admitted by ecclesiastics throughout the West, and even to a lesser degree in the East. He exerted this authority chiefly by means of letters to bishops and secular rulers in all parts of the Roman world, but also in other ways. His Book of Pastoral Rule, containing advice to bishops, had a great influence throughout the earlier Middle Ages. It was intended as a guide to the duties of bishops, and was accepted as such. He wrote it in the first instance for the Bishop of Ravenna, and sent it also to the Bishop of Seville. Under Charlemagne, it was given to bishops at consecration. Alfred the Great translated it into Anglo-Saxon. In the East, it was circulated in Greek. It gives sound, if not surprising, advice to bishops, such as not to neglect business. It tells them also that rulers should not be criticized, but should be kept alive to the danger of hellfire if they fail to follow the advice of the Church. Gregory's letters are extraordinarily interesting, not only as showing his character, but as giving a picture of his age. His tone, except to the emperor and the ladies of the Byzantine court, is that of a headmaster, sometimes commending, often reproving, never showing the faintest hesitation as to his right to give orders. Let us take as a sample his letters during 1 year, 599. The first is a letter to the Bishop of Cagliari in Sardinia, who, though old, was bad. It says in part, "It has been told me that on the Lord's Day, before celebrating the solemnities of Mass, thou wentest forth to plough up the crop of the bearer of these presents. Also, after the solemnities of Mass, thou didst not fear to root up the landmarks of that possession. Seeing that we still spare thy grey hairs, bethink thee at length, old man, and restrain thyself from such levity of behaviour and perversity of deeds." He writes at the same time to the secular authorities of Sardinia on the same subject. The bishop in question next has to be reproved because he makes a charge for conducting funerals, and then again because, with his sanction, a converted Jew placed the cross and an image of the Virgin in a synagogue. Moreover, he and other Sardinian bishops have been known to travel without permission of their metropolitan. This must cease. Then follows a very severe letter to the proconsul of Dalmatia, saying, among other things, "We see not of what sort your satisfaction is either to God or men." And again, "With regard to your seeking to be in favour with us, it is fitting that with your whole heart and soul, and with tears, as becomes you, you should satisfy your Redeemer for such things as these." I am ignorant as to what the wretch had done. Next comes a letter to Callinicus, exarch of Italy, congratulating him on a victory over the Slavs, and telling him how to act towards the heretics of Istria, who erred as to the three chapters. He writes also on this subject to the Bishop of Ravenna. Once, by way of exception, we find a letter to the Bishop of Syracuse, in which Gregory defends himself instead of finding fault with others. The question at issue is a weighty one, namely, whether Alleluia should be said at a certain point in the Mass. Gregory's usage, he says, is not adopted from subservience to the Byzantines, as the Bishop of Syracuse suggests, but is derived from St. James via the Blessed Jerome. Those who thought he was being unduly subservient to Greek usage were therefore in error. A similar question was one of the causes of the schism of the old believers in Russia. There are a number of letters to barbarian sovereigns, male and female. Brunehild, Queen of the Franks, wanted the pallium conferred on a certain French bishop, and Gregory was willing to grant her request. But unfortunately, the emissary she sent was a schismatic. To Agilulf, King of the Lombards, he writes congratulating him on having made peace. For if, unhappily, peace had not been made, what else could have ensued but, with sin and danger on both sides, the shedding of the blood of miserable peasants whose labour profits both? At the same time, he writes to Agilulf's wife, Queen Theolinda, telling her to influence her husband to persist in good courses. He writes again to Brunehild to find fault with two things in her kingdom: that laymen are promoted at once to be bishops without a probationary time as ordinary priests, and that Jews are allowed to have Christian slaves. To Theodoric and Theodobert, kings of the Franks, he writes saying that owing to the exemplary piety of the Franks, he would like to utter only pleasant things, but he cannot refrain from pointing out the prevalence of simony in their kingdom. He writes again about a wrong done to the Bishop of Turin. One letter to a barbarian sovereign is wholly complimentary. It is to Richard, King of the Visigoths, who had been an Arian, but became a Catholic in 587. For this, the Pope rewards him by sending him a small key from the most sacred body of the blessed Apostle Peter to convey his blessing, containing iron from his chains, that what had bound his neck for martyrdom may loose yours from all sins. I hope His Majesty was pleased with his present. The Bishop of Antioch is instructed as to the heretical synod of Ephesus, and informed that it has come to our ears that in the churches of the East no one attains to a sacred order except by giving of bribes, a matter which the bishop is to rectify wherever it is in his power to do so. The Bishop of Marseille is reproached for breaking certain images which were being adored. It is true that adoration of images is wrong, but images nevertheless are useful and should be treated with respect. Two bishops of Gaul are reproached because a lady who had become a nun was afterwards forced to marry. "If this be so, you shall have the office of hirelings, and not the merit of shepherds." The above are a few of the letters of a single year. It is no wonder that he found no time for contemplation, as he laments in one of the letters of this year. Gregory was no friend to secular learning. To Desiderius, Bishop of Vienne in France, he writes, "It came to our ears, what we cannot mention without shame, that thy fraternity is, that is, thou art, in the habit of expounding grammar to certain persons. This thing we took so much amiss, and so strongly disapproved it, that we changed what had been said before into groaning and sadness, since the praises of Christ cannot find room in one mouth with the praises of Jupiter. In proportion as it is execrable for such a thing to be related of a priest, it ought to be ascertained by strict and veracious evidence whether or not it be so. This hostility to pagan learning survived in the church for at least 4 centuries, till the time of Gerbert, Sylvester II. It was only from the 11th century onward that the church became friendly to learning. Gregory's attitude to the emperor is much more deferential than his attitude to barbarian kings. Writing to a correspondent in Constantinople, he says, "What pleases the most pious emperor, whatever he commands to be done, is in his power. As he determines, so let him provide. Only let him not cause us to be mixed up in the deposition of an Orthodox bishop. Still, what he does, if it is canonical, we will follow. But if it is not canonical, we will bear it, so far as we can, without sin of our own." When the Emperor Maurice was dethroned by a mutiny, of which the leader was an obscure centurion named Phocas, this upstart acquired the throne and proceeded to massacre the 5 sons of Maurice in their father's presence, after which he put to death the aged emperor himself. Phocas was, of course, crowned by the Patriarch of Constantinople, who had no alternative but death. What is more surprising is that Gregory, from the comparatively safe distance of Rome, wrote letters of fulsome adulation to the usurper and his wife. "There is this difference," he writes, "between the kings of the nations and the emperors of the republic, that the kings of the nations are lords of slaves, but the emperors of the republic lords of free men. May Almighty God, in every thought and deed, keep the heart of your piety, that is you, in the hand of his grace. And whatsoever things should be done justly, whatsoever things with clemency, may the Holy Spirit who dwells in your breast direct." And to the wife of Phocas, the Empress Leontia, he writes, "What tongue may suffice to speak, what mind to think, what great thanks we owe to Almighty God for the serenity of your empire, in that such hard burdens of long duration have been removed from our necks, and the gentle yoke of imperial supremacy has returned." One might suppose Maurice to have been a monster. In fact, he was a good old man. Apologists excuse Gregory on the plea that he did not know what atrocities had been committed by Phocas, but he certainly knew the customary behavior of Byzantine usurpers, and he did not wait to ascertain whether Phocas was an exception. The conversion of the heathen was an important part of the increasing influence of the church. The Goths had been converted before the end of the 4th century, by Ulfilas or Ulfila, unfortunately to Arianism, which was also the creed of the Vandals. After the death of Theodoric, however, the Goths became gradually Catholic. The king of the Visigoths, as we have seen, adopted the Orthodox faith in the time of Gregory. The Franks were Catholic from the time of Clovis. The Irish were converted before the fall of the Western Empire by St. Patrick, a Somersetshire country gentleman, who lived among them from 432 till his death in 461. The Irish, in turn, did much to evangelize Scotland and the north of England. In this work, the greatest missionary was St. Columba. Another was St. Columban, who wrote long letters to Gregory on the date of Easter and other important questions. The conversion of England, apart from Northumbria, was Gregory's special care. Everyone knows how, before he was pope, he saw 2 fair-haired, blue-eyed boys in the slave market in Rome, and on being told they were Angles, replied, "No, angels." When he became pope, he sent St. Augustine to Kent to convert them. There are many letters in his correspondence to St. Augustine, to Edilbert, king of the Angeli, and to others about the mission. Gregory decrees that heathen temples in England are not to be destroyed, but the idols are to be destroyed, and the temples then consecrated as churches. St. Augustine puts a number of queries to the Pope, such as whether cousins may marry, whether spouses who have had intercourse the previous night may come to church, yes, if they have washed, says Gregory, and so on. The mission, as we know, prospered, and that is why we are all Christians at this day. The period we have been considering is peculiar in the fact that though its great men are inferior to those of many other epochs, their influence on future ages has been greater. Roman law, monasticism, and the papacy owe their long and profound influence very largely to Justinian, Benedict, and Gregory. The men of the 6th century, though less civilized than their predecessors, were much more civilized than the men of the next 4 centuries, and they succeeded in framing institutions that ultimately tamed the barbarians. It is noteworthy that, of the above 3 men, 2 were aristocratic natives of Rome, and the 3rd was Roman emperor. Gregory is in a very real sense the last of the Romans. His tone of command, while justified by his office, has its instinctive basis in Roman aristocratic pride. After him, for many ages, the city of Rome ceased to produce great men. But in its downfall, it succeeded in fettering the souls of its conquerors. The reverence which they felt for the chair of Peter was an outcome of the awe which they felt for the throne of the Caesars. In the East, the course of history was different. Mahomet was born when Gregory was about 30 years old. Part 2. The Schoolmen. Chapter 7. The Papacy in the Dark Ages. During the 4 centuries from Gregory the Great to Sylvester II, the papacy underwent astonishing vicissitudes. It was subject at times to the Greek emperor, at other times to the Western emperor, and at yet other times to the local Roman aristocracy. Nevertheless, vigorous popes in the 8th and 9th centuries, seizing propitious moments, built up the tradition of papal power. The period from AD 600 to 1000 is of vital importance for the understanding of the medieval church and its relation to the state. The popes achieved independence of the Greek emperors, not so much by their own efforts as by the arms of the Lombards, to whom, however, they felt no gratitude whatever. The Greek church remained always, in a great measure, subservient to the emperor, who considered himself competent to decide on matters of faith as well as to appoint and depose bishops, even patriarchs. The monks strove for independence of the emperor, and for that reason sided at times with the pope. But the patriarchs of Constantinople, though willing to submit to the emperor, refused to regard themselves as in any degree subject to papal authority. At times, when the emperor needed the pope's help against barbarians in Italy, he was more friendly to the pope than the patriarch of Constantinople was.